We embedded our counselors into our fire stations, and as you can imagine, that was not a popular decision with the firefighters. I've used my position in the mental wellness area to impart early on, these are the struggles that you're probably going to face. These are the methods that will help you get through these struggles. I've had some of the crustiest captains that are hard to crack come to me and be like, hey man, like, we appreciate what you're doing and this program is good. What's something that's not revolutionary, that's not mind-blowing, but it's able to be replicated? What can we do? Because we don't want to just change the department, we want to change the fire service.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. This episode, we'll be speaking with Jason Korthel, Speaker Director of Ironclad Wellness and Division Chief of Training in Harris County, Texas, Emergency Services District 13. We'll be talking about his personal journey with post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic growth, introducing wellness and fitness programs into his organizations, and the successes from it. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, ubsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, all the podcast platforms, and visit our website for past episodes and guest information. It's respondertv.com. We'll be right back to speak with Jason after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMTB.
Today we're joined by Chief Jason Korthel. He's a fourth-generation firefighter who started his career in 2004. He's also a proud Marine Corps veteran after serving 4 years. Chief Korthel also serves as a Division Chief of Training and the Wellness Fitness Director for his department, as well as many other works within the organization's public relations roles. Jason has a great passion and drive for progressing mental wellness in first responder organizations through both personal and professional battles and experiences. He has implemented and influenced many others in the pursuit of providing first responders with the help that they need by starting an initiative website, ironcladwellness.com. Jason's also in the beginning stages of writing his book, Disentanglement Division. Jason, warm welcome to Respond Resilience.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jason, what inspired your passion, you know, for what you feel your mission is?
I think it comes from my story. I didn't ever obviously have a goal or dream to end up in this position. It simply just kind of played out that way. The fact that I had some very difficult times and some run-ins with some addiction problems and some very traumatic calls, and then obviously the big mayday that really sent me spiraling out of control. All of that kind of empowered me to make sure that I was giving all the resources I could in a customized, unique way to our firefighters, so that they didn't have to go through the hoops and all the tape that I went through to try to get the help that I needed. And so that drives me. I mean, honestly, if it's one thing, it's you know, making a mark in the fire service before I turn it over to the next generation.
And what was your awareness about wellness before your journey started?
Nothing. Nothing. I didn't even have a basis. And I mean, to be quite honest, it was hard for me to even think about what I would tell somebody or what I would talk about, because I was under the perception that We were a special group of people that no one understood. No one could understand us unless you were a firefighter or, you know, a first responder in general. So there was really no point to speaking with anybody. And that was kind of the mindset that I grew up in within the fire service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, we hear that a lot.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Jason, you mentioned the May Day incident and also that, you know, we've said in the early in the intro about the PTG. Can you talk a little bit about what the event or events were that led up to your PTS and PTG?
Yeah, so in 2014, I was going through a divorce process with my ex-wife. I had three small children that were obviously affected by the process as well. It wasn't, I guess, an easy thing to go through. I'm assuming most divorces never are, but, you know, when you involve children, that can really put a lot of stressors on both parties. And I started finding my solace in work and staying after work. And that's where I felt like I had a little bit more control over my circumstances, because I didn't have control at the house. And so I just poured myself into work, which to me, looking back, is unhealthy. To get away from the place that potentially is harming you in the sense that you're away from your family, you're away from some social relationships outside of the fire service that can really be beneficial to you, and you're going back to this place that can literally kill you, and you're staying there voluntarily. Those type of things can start to spiral really quick. And so 2014 ended, went through a rough holiday season. Started buying into society's idea of what somebody going through a divorce should be doing. That's alcohol, that's addiction, that's whatever I could get my hands on. And on top of that, developing poor social relationships with both men and women. Hanging out with a group of guys that I would never hang out with, that would, you know, do hard drugs and, you know, be with a party crowd, and then, you know, going out with different girls, you know, as many times a week as I possibly could, which wasn't me. I mean, that's not how I was brought up. That's not something that was normal for me. But buying into society really, really hampered who I was in actuality. And then March 27th of 2015, I was at my part-time job, which is now my full-time job. I was at my part-time job. I worked full-time in a town just south of Houston called Pearland. And while I was at Cypress Creek or Harris County ESD 13, we got a call for a response at about 6 minutes prior to getting off of work. Mm-hmm. And we came out of the station and we saw the header. And so we knew that we had a pretty good burner. We were mutual aiding a department next to us, and it was a good apartment fire when we arrived. And to kind of give the brief overview of what happened, we were supposed to go to the Charlie side of the building, the rear of the building, and start our stretch and our attack from there. I was the lieutenant on the truck for the day. And so I was giving my guys assignments. And I had my nozzleman up top on the third division. We were trying to access the attic. And I had one of my best friends still to this day, both outside and inside the fire service, next to me. And we were shucking hose up the stairs to try to get it to our nozzleman so he had enough slack. And I felt something kind of brush my right shoulder. And I thought that was weird because nothing should be coming down on top of us. We weren't making an interior attack. We weren't doing anything, you know, crazy. And you're always usually taught that the stairwell is a pretty safe place to be if you have to bail out. And so as soon as I felt my right shoulder dip a little bit, I instinctively grabbed my buddy by his chest and I pulled him into me because I thought that the stairs were falling on his side. And really, the stairs were falling on my side. So I pulled him into the collapse with me, not knowing, obviously, what I was doing. And we can joke about it today. But I pulled him into me. And we essentially had both a stairwell and a landing from the second and third floor come down on top of us. Mm-hmm. And somehow my radio and all of that mess got dislodged from how I was holding it or how it was in my pocket. I can't remember exactly, but I know I had my radio because there's radio traffic with me talking. And so I didn't even get to call my own Mayday, and I couldn't have called my own Mayday because I was pinned down underneath these concrete stairs. And I just remember my buddy screaming that his legs were burning because he came down on top of a bunch of embers. Uh-huh. And I was trying to, with my one free hand, I had my right hand outstretched in front of me and I had my left hand pinned underneath me. I was trying to sweep underneath his legs to try to get as much embers out from under him as possible. And the way he fell, he had basically his head in between his legs, his knees. Oh. And so his SCBA bottle was holding up the whole landing on top of him. And every time he tried to dislodge himself, it would get a little bit worse and a little bit worse because the weight would just come down on top of him. Mm-hmm. So he ended up passing out. Losing consciousness probably 3 or 4 times. I would try to be screaming to him and hey man, like, are you there? You okay? You know, they're coming to get us. You know, I heard somebody call him Mayday. They're coming to get us. But every time I picked up my face from my mask to call out to him, I would lose a bunch of air because my regulator hose was trapped underneath my stomach. And so my mask wouldn't move up with my face. And so I knew that I had to start conserving air because at that time, I didn't know what was on top of us. I thought the whole building fell in on us. So I was preparing for the long game. And basically, I started thinking, like, I'm going to go out. You know, I'm going to go out this way for sure. Like, this is. And a lot of my, you know, they tell you in fire school that your foundational training is going to kick in. You know, one day your foundational training, you're going to need it. You're going to revert back to it. And sure enough, I mean, it really did. And so, you know, those few minutes that I was underneath all that rubble really kind of felt like 2 days. It felt like we were stuck underneath there forever. And I know a lot of people say that, but it's so true. You know, it was probably 5 to 7 minutes tops, but it felt like forever. And when we did that, they had another crew come down. They basically stopped fire operations and they dumped everybody over to us, which obviously if there's some firefighters listening, and I'm sure LT knows that you don't want to stop fire operations. That's what's making the scene a lot worse, right? You want to have other resources address your Mayday. And so actually I'm with the guy at conference right now that was there with me when that happened. They ended up pulling me out from the rubble, and I remember holding on to my buddy's pant leg and making sure, like, he's coming out with me for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not leaving without him. Uh-huh. And they assured me that he was on his way to getting out. So they transported us, and that was super emotional, you know, obviously. Lots of tears and lots of hugging and stuff like that. They actually ended up transporting us in the same ambulance. But one thing that I very vividly remember is my assistant chief, who came to the scene, obviously, because he heard the Mayday. I'm laying in the back of the ambulance, and he came to me and he said, hey, who do I call? Like, who do you want me to call? Because he knew I was going through a divorce and stuff, you know, and he didn't want to overstep and call my ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And I just remember sitting there in the ambulance and I'm like, damn, I don't have anybody. I don't have anyone for you to call, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. And my mom at the time, which is in my book, but my mom at the time was not in my life. She was struggling with her own addiction and her own problems. And my dad lives in Oregon. And so I didn't have anybody. Eventually my ex-stepdad got the phone call, and he came up and was great to have him. And he's still in my life today. But that was kind of the first moment that I felt isolated and alone. Mm-hmm. To that degree. I I physically felt alone. I emotionally felt alone. And I didn't know it at the time, but what that incident brought to me was a lot of attention. And for somebody who's in addiction, with the addictions that I had, attention was just an exacerbator. I mean, it really cranked everything up to the next level. So being media famous and being addicted to, you know, basically poor societal standards, it's just like if a celebrity or a rock star gets that fame finally, and things just took off for the worse. So that was kind of the mayday, and then the ensuing issues that I dealt with only got worse from there.
What would you say turned things around for you eventually in order to seek treatment and EMDR and some of the other things that you've been involved with?
I think my wife, I call her my support human because that's just what she is. She's amazing. And obviously my children, looking at them and not wanting them to grow up in a situation that I've experienced. They were young at the time when we went through a divorce, and they're 10, 13, and 15 now. And so they're very impressionable, and they're going to start remembering things, which scares the hell out of me. It makes me realize that I need to do right because they're going to remember these things now. And so that definitely helped. I really think starting to understand that therapy is okay. I got to listen to David Griffin speak in, I think, 2014, Dr. David Griffin. And I've reached out to him a few times, and we've shared some emails back and forth. But I told him, I said, your story that I listened to in 2014 played out in my own life, obviously in my own way, but it did. And he comes from a bad incident with the Charleston 9 that passed away. And he was the first in driver on that. And then he went into a life of addiction and struggle. And I think that was preemptively something that I could look back on when I got to the point that I was ready to get sober and figure out life and try to figure out life. And I think looking back at his story, it didn't make me feel alone for the first time. And that was really cool to know that someone can be as successful as him in the fire service and not get it right all the time.
Right. We hear that. We hear this story a lot for people that go on to inspire wellness in other first responders. Usually they have a low point. You know, we say there's like that breakdown or hitting rock bottom before you can break through and climb up, you know? And so on the one hand, it's unfortunate that you had to go through that. And many of the inspiring individuals that we interview have had to go through that. But on the flip side, you also are an inspiration, you know? And so we need to hear from people like you.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
I'd like to know more about your, you know, the Ironclad Wellness Program. That this is something that you and your wife have built. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah. So my wife, she's my right hand woman. She is with me through this thing through and through. The initiative that I started, it isn't necessarily I don't want to call it a business because I'm not out here trying to make money off this thing. I'm just trying to get the word out. So it's more of an initiative for me. My parents just got on board. My dad and my stepmom, they are my social media managers. So they manage all my social media accounts that are brand new as of like 3 weeks ago. And so that's been an interesting those have been interesting conversations with them, trying to get my social media account set up. They're a little bit older, so it's funny to try to get them to figure out social media and the inner workings.
I would think your kids would do that. Because,
yeah, you know, no, I don't want TikTok videos and all that. No one needs to see me dancing on my social media. No, I mean, the website itself was just built just so I could get people's attention and they could look back at my story as far back. I mean, when I did Chief Gazaway's first podcast, and it's on my website, when I did Chief Richard Gazaway, Dr. Gazaway as well, when I did his first podcast, I mean, I was right in the thick of my addiction and right in the thick of coming off of a very traumatic incident. And so by documenting that and then going through, you know, something like this podcast or a recent podcast that I've done with Mike Galliano, I want people to see the difference and see the change and see what the topics are about. And that's really, that was my platform for this thing. And so sharing my stories through podcasts and through articles or by, you know, just simple conferences and speaking, like you said, I think it's important. And I try to empower everybody that can, you know, see me or hear me to tell their own stories, because I know that a lot of firefighters, a lot of EMS folks and police, they have these awesome stories. But I also think that it's important that they prepare their hearts to share those stories, because a lot of times, unfortunately, when you share a story, there's a lot of judgment passed, and you have to be prepared to share your story and then be prepared to take on the naysayers and the folks that'll, you know, beat you back down or try to beat you back down.
Don't you think that part of building the courage to tell your story is knowing that standing in your power and eventually speaking your truth will set you free?
Oh yes. Yeah. 100%. And it was funny because, you know, I don't drink anymore, but I, after conferences and especially after I speak, I know a lot of people don't come up to me right after the conference, right? They want to come after me, you know, at the happy hour after they've had a few drinks, and then they start talking and, you know, I know the routine. And so we had a gentleman last night that came up and he was, you know, he has a story and it's very similar to mine. And he had obviously had a few drinks, but I was trying to kind of cut through all that and get to the heart. And really what he said is, he said, I'm in charge of 38 people and I have a story and I want them to know my story. And I said, okay. I said, well, what's the next step for you? And he goes, I'm just going to tell him. And I said, man, I said, I want to encourage you to tell your story, but I also want to let you know that you need to make sure the receivers are ready to hear your story. You know, he was a brand new chief officer. And, you know, I said, just wait a little bit until you feel like you're, you know, steady in your ways. And, yeah, I think it took, you know, I had another gentleman come up to me and say, how many times have you shared your story and does it get easier? And I said, yeah, I said, it gets easier. You start really keying into, you know, the parts of the story that are impactful that people want to hear. And then, you know, with whatever crowd you're speaking to, that kind of dictates your story too. You know, the fire chiefs got to hear the full Monty last night. So they got to hear the whole shebang. My lowest of lows to my highs of highs. Now, I did a community risk reduction conference in Colorado not too long ago, and that was a little bit different of a presentation, but they still got a lot out of it. I agree. As you tell your story more and more, it gets so much easier. I used to be exhausted after telling my story. I would come back to the hotel room and I would just lay on the bed, and my wife would be like, "You're all right?" And I'm like, "I'm exhausted." Like, that was exhausting to me. But now it's getting a lot better.
Yeah, it's got to be a process of, you know, telling it for the first time, and then each consecutive time with different audiences, maybe a different context. And in fact, since you're writing a book, that's another way of telling your story and sharing it out. In a way, it's like you can be very deliberate about it, because then you can take your time, edit things, kind of go back and refine things or focus things differently than one can when you're speaking live.
When you retire, you're just another employee that's gone. In 10 years, you'll be, "Oh, yeah, that's a good old what's his name."
And sometimes I think for a lot of us, it's scary to retire when you've been raised by an organization for almost 3 decades.
There's a running joke that says that as you retire, you're forgotten about before you even leave the parking lot.
It wasn't that I was losing the passion for the job. I decided I want to go ahead and transition and start traveling and talking to groups of people.
I lost who I was. I didn't have any plans for the future. I sunk.
And we're always saving for a rainy day. And what ends up happening is you die and you never receive the benefit of you working so hard for so long.
It's as if you've lost a loved one. For me, there's a sadness there.
They really do become your second family.
I was a firefighter. That was always what I wanted to do. Sometimes life throws you a curveball and you find yourself without an identity.
I would pass police cars and it was like somebody punched me in the stomach. Like, I got sick because I missed it so bad.
When you say I'm a retired firefighter, people, they notice. They're like, "Wow, man, that's incredible." And it provides an avenue for you to be impactful.
Talk a little bit about the book, Disentanglement Division. Like, how does that relate to your story? And part B is, now as a chief of training, like, how has all this affected your the way that you train firefighters?
Yeah, so Disentanglement Division, I mean, I was kicking around a bunch of different titles, like I'm sure a lot of folks do, a lot of authors do, and I looked back at my life and I just thought to myself, like, what has my life been, you know? And I was trying to find one word to describe it. And I'm like, I've been tangled up in a lot of crap, you know? And so I was like, disentanglement's a cool word. And then being a division chief, division kind of popped up and I was like, it'd be cool to have a book called Disentanglement Division. Like, we're a division of disentangling all these issues that I came up with along the way of my path of being in the fire service, but also life as well. But disentangling all those things, it felt like there was a division of people, like a training division or operations division, that were part of that journey, and they were in that division with me, and we were disentangling my life as we went along. And so that's how I kind of came up with the title. Move that direction. As far as the division chief for the training role that I came into, so a little backstory on that. I had always been huge into academia, huge into training. No matter what role I was in the fire service, I always had a knack to help out the person who was in charge of training, whether that was a training chief or a training lieutenant or what have you. And an opportunity came up in, I believe it was 2017 or 2018 for the training chief position. And at that time, I don't think I was ready to fully come off of operations yet. I was a district chief, which for us is a for us as a district chief, but for others, it's a battalion chief. So I was still running calls and I was still, you know, kind of one of the guys and all that stuff. I still didn't get in all the cool text message groups, but I still got to eat dinner with them. So that was fun. And then a opportunity came up in 2021 for our training chief position. And I, you know, had talked with my wife and she was a big promoter of it. And she wanted me home, you know, every night. And I don't know if she does anymore, but at that time, she was home every night. And the kids were a huge factor, too. Missing those holidays and missing those birthdays and those sporting events. It just got old, you know, it got tiring. And, you know, my sleep pattern was out of control. My health was terrible. My drinking was terrible. Everything was pretty much terrible. And I got this, you know, 9-to-5 position and I'm like, man, this is cool. This is awesome. I was completely off all dinner lists and text message lists at that point. I think once you go to an administrative chief, people will just kind of cut you out. So I've been finding a new group of chief friends to hang out with that can share in my misery. And we like to hang out a lot and talk about the role. But employing others as a training chief has been an awesome feeling to see transformation within people. I also teach at the college, at the local college, at the fire academy. And so I get these kids off the street, same with the fire department as well as a training chief. I get these kids off the street and I say kids, some of them are, you know, older adults, but I get these guys and gals off the streets and I get to see them transform into firefighters. And I've used my position in the mental wellness area to impart early on. These are the struggles that you're probably going to face. These are the methods that will help you get through these struggles. I've tried really hard to throw the kitchen sink at these folks, you know, and one of the guys yesterday asked me, how do I get my guys to a point where they're comfortable telling me if they have a problem? And I said, there's no way. I said, you can't. I said, you know, you can facilitate all you can. I said, but if they're not ready to tell you their problems, they're not going to tell you their problems. And I told him, I said, man, I rest my head easy at night knowing that I have resources when they do tell me their problems that we can go from there and we can help them. I said, but as far as prompting someone to tell you their story, that's you know, dicey to me. So that's how I've used my position for the betterment. Of making sure that these folks and I say kids know exactly what they're getting into, because when I went through fire school, there nothing. I mean, I would say as early as maybe 3 or 4 years ago, there was still nothing. And so we're making a hard push right now in the academies and the onboarding process for our department to make sure that these folks know what they're getting into.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your mental health wellness program that you and Liz built for the organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2016, I got hired on as a district chief for our department. That was my home department that I walked into when I was 19 years old. And I've just been able to stay with them. And it's been a true blessing to be able to do that. And I didn't have a role necessarily. I had a title and a rank, but I didn't have a role within the department. So I thought, man, let me get a fitness initiative together, you know, and make sure that it's within NFPA standards. And IAFF had some things coming out about wellness and fitness. And so my main goal at that time was to get workout equipment at each station and make sure that every station had workout equipment, because we knew cardiovascular health was on top of the agenda. And I felt so accomplished when I convinced the fire chief that we needed workout equipment and we needed to stop our gym membership that people weren't using, because we would pay for their gym membership and then they wouldn't go. So Liz came in, I would say late 2016. And she had been a volunteer firefighter with us for a while and then suffered a couple injuries. And so she wanted to stay with the department in a safety officer role and just kind of bounce some ideas off of me. So I said, okay. So we met up and Liz was like, have you ever thought of maybe doing a mental wellness side instead of just, you know, fitness? And I said, no. I said, I haven't thought about it. And that sounds like a big undertaking. I don't know if I'm, you know, ready to do all that. And, of course, you know, Liz being who she is, the academic and self-proclaimed is what she says, nerd. She brought a lot of data to me. And she said, look, this is what's going on. And these are just a fraction of the numbers that are being reported. She's like, I think we would benefit from having a program. So she stayed on it. And we sat down and we got together and we said, you know, what's something that's not revolutionary, that's not mind-blowing, but it's able to be replicated? What can we do? Because we don't want to just change the department. We want to change the fire service. And so we came up with a common three-pillar approach, and we just tweaked those three pillars a little bit just for our department. And so we have a chaplaincy program that has two chaplains. It has a female and a male chaplain by design, and I think that's important. And then we have a peer support group, which is comprised of 11 people. And the way that peer support group was formed, my first question was, would you take part in the peer support group yourself? Like, would you refer yourself to peer support group if you were struggling? And of course, everyone said no, right? No, I'm not going to peer support group. I don't need that. But then the second question was, would you refer someone else to peer support group? And of course, the answer was yes. And so I'm like, these dang firefighters, like, won't take care of themselves, but they'll send their buddies to this program, right?
Yeah.
And I knew that was going to happen somewhat by design, but I just wanted to make sure I was verifying what I thought was going to happen. And so then the third, I guess, question or survey was, if you had to choose seven people to know your deepest, darkest secrets and your story, who would you choose? And so they got to select seven out of 150 people, which is our entire roster, including our administrative staff.
Right.
And then the last question that I paired with question number three to form our peer support group was, would you be interested in being part of the peer support group? Would you be peer support And so I took number three and number four, and I paired them up because even though somebody might be trusted within the department, if they said they didn't want to be part of the peer support group, I'm not going to be like, hey, man, a lot of people trust you, but you said you didn't want to do this. Would you reconsider? I'm not going to go down that road. So I luckily found 11 folks that were – actually, I found 10 folks, and I'll tell you about the 11th here in a second. I found 10 folks that that were voted on and that were you know, highly, highly respected within the department. And within those 10 folks, I made sure that there was females and males again. I made sure that each shift had a representative. I made sure that most of the ranks, if not all the ranks, were represented. And then obviously the different pay grades. We still have a few volunteers left. We have some part-time firefighters. And then we have obviously our full-time firefighters. So I wanted an array of the demographics to be represented with the peer support group. And then one of my chaplains, who's also a peer support group member, came to me and said, hey, my wife was interested in helping out any way she can with peer support. And I was like, man, that's kind of off the wall. Like, she's never done this before. I don't know how she can relate to the firefighters and all this. And then I got to thinking, I'm like, this lady's been a nurse pretty much her whole life. You know, she's seen a lot of things. And I said, she's been, you know, married to this firefighter for 30 years plus. So I know that they've gone through some things and they've experienced loss of a child and all kinds of ups and downs. And I said, I wonder if I can make her a spouse peer support specialist, someone that firefighter spouse can come to and talk to. And then if we have maybe a young firefighter couple that's going through it, you know, in the first years of their marriage, like we seem to do, I can sit them down with, you know, with this individual and his wife, and they can hash it out and be like, yeah, the rough part's starting, and it's probably not going to end for a couple more years, but it does get better. And so that's where I really brought his spouse in, and she's been great. She goes to all our trainings. She goes above and beyond what I expected. And so that's been really nice. And then the clinical side of things for the professional counseling, we got really lucky. I say we hit a home run right off the bat. We had a counseling group in our district, and I went with the counseling group instead of just one clinician, just because it seems to be a little bit easier for people to transition to a different counselor if they're in a counseling center than if they just use one clinician. Because if that clinician isn't their, you know, type of flavor, they can just go to the next counselor. They don't have to redo their insurance and redo their registration and re-explain their issues and all this stuff. They can just say, hey, I'm not feeling this guy. Can I switch over to this lady? I've heard good things. Yeah, sure. No problem. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I went with the counseling center for those reasons. We embedded our counselors into our fire stations. And as you can imagine, that was not a popular decision with the firefighters, because you put an outsider and a mole and a, what they call them, a shrink. Yeah, a mole. Yeah, mind reader, witch doctor, whatever.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Them,
right. So
Ouija board specialist.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, these guys and the gals just cracked me up because, being one myself, I feel like I can say this. A lot of times they're like small children. Like they know what they want, but they don't know what they need, you know? And so I'm like, all right, man, like, you know, just bear with it for a month, man. Give it a month and let's see how it works. So what we did is we took a single counselor, and, you know, this was the eventual clinician, the director. And so she came into the stations and she rode out with the guys and gals and made some calls and ate some dinner and, you know, sat through some awkward movies where the guys didn't talk to her at all. And, you know, it was funny because I told her, I said, you know, when you come into the firehouse, there's going to be some folks that don't talk at all. And she's like, okay. And I said, so it's going to be probably pretty awkward. And she goes, I can out awkward, I promise you. And I was like, all right. So it was an awkward war going on in the stations for a little bit. And so then it was funny because I started getting phone calls and emails, and we were going through a transition. She was transitioning to the clinical director. And so we were having different counselors come through, and all of a sudden everyone's like, where's Michelle? And I'm like, what do you mean? Where's Michelle? She got promoted, and they're like, well, she went to 23. She didn't come to 22s. And I'm like, are you like upset that she's like going to a different station and not coming to see y'all? Well, yeah, we miss her. And I'm like, okay. I was like, I see exactly what you guys are doing here. So it's been, you know, I'm not going to say that I have 100% buy-in from all my folks. That's not the case. That'll never be the case.
Sure.
But I've had some of the crustiest, most crabby captains that are hard to crack come to me and be like, hey man, like, we appreciate what you're doing, and this program is good, you know, this program is good. And hearing from those captains, I know that the company officer in the fire service is the backbone of the company, or is the backbone of the fire service. And knowing that, you know, these company officers that are you know, hard on the outside, and they're hard shells to crack, knowing that they can come to me and be like, hey, your program is doing good things in the department. That really gives me the motivation, you know, to keep pursuing this thing. So that's our program in a nutshell. We offer counseling appointments to family members, to the spouses, the children. They have play therapy, and all that good stuff. I mean, we helped great. Fund their play therapy room. So they did a bunch of like fire station toys and fire trucks on the walls and pictures and stuff. Yeah.
Great stuff.
Kind of an ode to us, since we helped fund them a little bit. But, I would say overall the program has been awesome, and probably the most unique approach that we've done and that we'll continue to do is embedding these counselors in the fire stations. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I'll add as well, before I get off my soapbox, is we were allowed to essentially have these counselors come into the firehouses and conduct on-site appointments. And what that did is that took away the need to make an appointment. It took away the need to miss work. It took away the need to, you know, establish insurance and all this stuff, because it was already there. Like, we already did that on the backside. Mm-hmm. They're already getting paid to be at the fire station. And so these guys and girls would you know, walk in and be like, hey, Tiffany, you got a second to talk out in the bay? Yeah, okay. So they go out in the bay, and it might be 15 minutes, might be an hour, you know. And it's been really nice for the guys and girls to have. It's funny because our embedding hours are down because it's we're working on a maintenance phase, right? We're not trying to hound these folks. The first year was a big push, a lot of hours, a lot of counselors in the stations. This year we're kind of reeling back a little bit to do a maintenance phase.
Right.
But our numbers for appointments are up. And so I it's interesting to me how that works out, you know, is how we draw back a little bit, but then the numbers are still going up. And my fire chief always jokes with me. He's like, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing that we have so many damn counseling appointments. You know, he's like, are we doing something right? Or are we doing something wrong? And I'm like, just let it go, chief, let it go. But it's all confidential. We don't see names. We just see numbers. So each time they go into the counseling office, they get assigned a unique PIN. And that's what they use to make sure that they are they're with the department and that they're getting the numbers that we need to stay afloat.
Question about funding, like how do you pay the counselors to be there?
Yeah, so like I said, when we found this organization, we hit a home run. They're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which is awesome. And they work on a sliding scale, and so if the first responder did have to pay for an actual appointment, it would be up to them the amount that they can pay. And so what we did is we said, well, we're going to go through insurance because it is going to be a little bit of cost savings there because our insurance coverage does pay for a portion of the appointment. We will cover whatever the insurance doesn't cover. So say an appointment's $70, the insurance pays $40, we'll pay the $30 to make up for it. So that's how that works out. We have an MOU with the counseling agency. And basically what that does is that gives us four training sessions, mandatory training sessions annually for every crew that's on shift. And we do an A shift, B shift and C shift, trainings. And we do a small group, and that runs us about $4,500 a year, for that. And then obviously, the free counseling is not really free counseling to us, but it is to the member. So it's pretty cost effective. And then when you talk about the embedding side of things, if you wanted to embed a counselor, we're looking at an average of about $4,500 a month. And that's probably the most expensive part, but that's something that you can highly regulate. You could have a counselor come in three times a month, and it be an A shift, B shift, and C shift, and it's something, you know, something to make it happen. So we're actually in the works of getting these counselors to come through a modified fire academy one weekend.
Great so, idea.
Yeah, we're gonna put some gear on them. We're gonna, you know, try to do some drills and whatnot, and we'll see if we can get some fire on them and hang out. So I think it'll be super cool. And they're all bought into it. They love it. And that's so cool to me.
That's great.
Your program is incredible. And our dream would be that this would be in every department and agency, that we'd have a clinician everywhere one day.
Sure. Yeah. I like I said, I've been blessed, lucky, whatever you want to call it, with this organization. And I've helped others find similar organizations to help them out. And like I told the folks yesterday when I was speaking, you know, a lot of these folks want to help. You know, it's not that they don't want to help. It's just they don't know where to start, or they don't know how to start it. You know, talking about the clinician side, very rarely, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're going to have a clinician knock on the fire department door and be like, hey, do y'all need a clinician? You know, that, right. that just doesn't happen. You as a fire chief, or you as an assistant chief, need to seek these folks out or seek these centers out. And it, most of the time, they're going to be at least receptive to the idea. Right. And a lot of people want to help the fire service. They want to help, you know, first responders. And I just think it's important to take that initiative.
Jason, you're doing some amazing progressive and very proactive programs. And we thank you so much for sharing all that with us, as well as your story. Tell us where people can find you out there on the internet, social media.
Yeah, so parents got the social media up and running. Just you can search Ironclad Wellness on Facebook. I believe I'm also on Instagram, and I am not yet on Twitter. So that is still getting worked on. But the preferred method is to go to my website. It's www.ironcladwellness.com. All my contact information is on there. So if someone wants to reach out and someone wants to ask a question, or if you need documentation, I know when I started the process, documentation was not out there. We didn't have right. SOPs or SOGs to help us guide this process. We have SOPs and SOGs for every element, behavioral health, peer support group, chaplaincy, wow. And also our licensed professional counseling. We have an SOP for everything. So if you need any of those documents to help kind of get you started, I'd be more than happy to share those through the website.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, wish you continued success, and especially with your upcoming book, Disentanglement Division, and with all your speaking engagements. Thank you, Jason, Chief, for being with us and sharing all this today. And we really value your contribution to the fire service.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's been great. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stacey.
Remember to like and subscribe our YouTube channel, Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV. We're also on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, every podcast platform for the most part. And come to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.